I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, patriotism is taught to us as a civic virtue. We started every school day reciting the Pledge of Allegiance. Many serve in the military and even give their lives for the nation. But there is a point where too much patriotism can become something else, nationalism. That's when love of country hardens into a belief that the nation is uniquely righteous, divinely favored, or exempt from ordinary moral judgment. When patriotism turns toxic, people are told to surrender their rights. You can't question the decisions of the leaders. Any honest scrutiny of the government becomes an act of disloyalty. It's not allowed. How does national pride turn into a justification for injustice? This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. 45 days after 9/11, a sweeping bill was passed by Congress and signed into law called the U.S. Patriot Act. The title itself was a political message opposing the legislation called the Patriot Act. It would make it sound that opposing it was somehow opposing patriotism or national security. The law did not abolish constitutional rights outright. Rather, it expanded surveillance, search, and investigative powers, while weakening some of the practical safeguards that protected privacy, speech, and due process. Then the president at that time, George W. Bush, declared, "Either you are with us or you're with the terrorist." That contributed to a political climate at the time which domestic criticism of the war on terror was sometimes was treated as a weakness or disloyalty. Today, President Trump frequently calls reporters who ask him about the way that the war with Iran is going. He says they're being disloyal. In March, he said a New York Times reporter who asked him a question, he said he was being treasonous for that question. After veteran 60 Minutes correspondent Scott Paley was fired by CBS News recently, Trump said Paley was and other similar journalists don't care about the country. When does patriotism become a weapon against the people? In the new book, To Love a Country, The Problem of Patriotism in America, Dominic Ezduzane probes the tension between patriotism and freedom. And Dominic, welcome to The Source.
Thanks very much.
So when you say there is a problem with patriotism in America, what do you mean?
I think you just described it rather perfectly there. I mean, you've got these constitutional rights. You have these historic liberties protecting freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, and protections against self-incrimination, etc. And that is, you know, the core kind of deposit of the American Revolution, in a sense. And yet those very treasures are violated when you say my country right or wrong, or when your patriotism is sort of channeled into a respect for the current government or the current administration, and then criticism becomes somehow kind of, as you say, some form of treachery.
Our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Join the conversation as we talk about patriotism and could it go too far? Does it become nationalism? What does that look like? Are we seeing that today? So, Dominic, is patriotism inherently dangerous, or does it get to a point where it becomes dangerous?
It's a really interesting question, because some of the people who inspired my book are people like, you know, Tolstoy or Rabindranath Tagore, the Indian poet and Nobel Prize winner, who are scared by patriotism. They see it as intrinsically divisive and, you know, leading to war. You know, that Tolstoy will say something like, you know, you can't talk about universal human brotherhood if you think your nation is in somehow preeminent. So I think that they would see most European patriotisms of the 19th century, for example, which led into imperialism, of course, as being inherently suspect. But I think we would want to say, well, surely there's a way to be a patriot without being, lording it over other people. And there's this great debate that I discuss very briefly in the book between Tagore and Gandhi. And Gandhi saying, look, I hear you on nationalism, but we really have to have some self-respect here. We've been forced to crawl along the streets by the British in India, and we really need to have an identity. We need a flag, indeed. We need symbols like the spinning wheel. We need to stop wearing English clothes. It's funny for me to be saying this as a Brit, but he makes probably the most eloquent case for a good patriotism, and one that he says patriotism spelled humanity, a patriotism that affirms other cultures, but is quite confident of its own values too.
American writer James Baldwin said, I love America more than any other country in this world, and exactly for this reason, I insist on the right to criticize her perpetually. What do you think he meant by that?
Yeah, I love that. I mean, we were talking just last week about the sort of rather cooler idea of some philosophers like Hannah Arendt, some of your listeners will be familiar with, who's just scared of the word love, scared of anything that love implies, these higher passions and these excitements that can lead to McCarthyism, that can lead to forms of persecution. Even innocent love is quite dangerous for Arendt, but I think I'm much more on the Baldwin side of it. You don't criticize something you don't love. I think, you know, contempt is much more dangerous than criticism. I haven't written an anti-American book by any description. People are saying, what are you doing, you know, as a Brit coming in like this? But there's so many great and sort of life-affirming aspects of the American tradition. And I see that when nationalism, when patriotism sort of bleeds into nationalism in a sense, and it ceases to be critical, it when it becomes offensive to criticize a state, that's when we get into trouble. So I definitely prefer the Baldwin emphasis on love. And I think the other person to mention here, of course, is Martin Luther King, who talks in his letter from Birmingham jail as speaking out through tears of love.
We are hearing from people from the left, Democratic Party, they're saying that Democrats need to reclaim patriotism. Mm-hmm. That doesn't necessarily mean just put on a flag pin. Should they be actually rethinking patriotism?
Exactly. I mean, I think that is the issue for me. I think that, you know, without making it in any way partisan, I think I was concerned, you know, 2016 was an interesting year because we had obviously the Trump election here and then Brexit back home. So I'm seeing this on both sides of the Atlantic. And I think the backward-looking patriotism, you know, so one of the responses to the Trump era has been to reclaim the flag and to reclaim patriotism as the healthy thing and nationalism as the toxic thing. But I think if patriotism involves exceptionalism and the idea of that inherent righteousness, it's dangerous and it leads to militarism. It leads to perhaps superficial solutions to the great problem of the racial divide. So I think the people who I really wanted to hold up in the book were people like King or Jane Addams, who say, let's look forward. Or Randolph Bourne, who is a great journalist in the First World War, who saw the tragedy of the First World War coming. And he has this great idea that he says, we must perpetrate the paradox that our American cultural tradition lies in the future. We have to take the plurality of modern life and the complexity and weave something more exciting and more forward-facing. Adams is similar because lots of people of Adams' generation were appalled by imperialism and the war, the Filipino war, and the conquest of the Philippines. And they were kind of, what would Jefferson do? And Adams is kind of, well, let's look forward. Maybe Jefferson and his notions of exceptionalism are part of the problem here. So I think it's a sort of forward-looking patriotism that we need as much as a backward-looking one, which draws on the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence.
And when you're stuck in a rigid form of patriotism, you're really not looking forward. You're basically facing backward, wanting to make America great again. You said you don't want to get political. I don't think we're going to be able to avoid that because there's a lot here. And our phone lines are open, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Where are you on patriotism, the right to protest, how that is a patriotic act when you are demanding that the country live up to its ideals? 833-877-8255. Source continues after a 1-minute break.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to rewarding policyholders who keep their workers safe and losses low. More at texasmutual.com/TXM Advantage. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. With me on the line, Dominic Erduzane. His new book is To Love a Country, The Problem of Patriotism in America. It examines the conflict between national loyalty and individual freedom, arguing that American exceptionalism has sometimes justified exclusion, enslavement, inequity, military aggression, restrictions on dissent. The book also considers whether a more democratic form of attachment to country can be grounded in liberty, equality, and justice. So we are told, we're instructed to give the Pledge of Allegiance when we're kids in school. And the line in there is liberty and justice for all. That is supposed to be what the country is about. But look around, and I don't think that's what we're getting, and I don't think that's what many of these leaders that we have in the country now are gaming for. So is that when critical patriotism should become a thing?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, I think the problem that someone like Jane Addams, or going back a bit earlier, Frederick Douglass or William Lloyd Garrison, the abolitionist, have, and the reason Garrison really saw himself as an internationalist rather than a patriot, is that he felt that the ceremonial aspects of patriotism were like a kind of self-congratulation that we've already arrived, and that it was fundamentally static, that it kind of closed down the question of what we could do. So in his case, you know, he's a massive admirer of the Declaration of Independence, but he feels that the Constitution kind of rode that back, and well, it did. You know, you have property in persons, you have fugitive slave clauses, etc., three-fifths clauses, etc. And he felt that 4th of July oratory was one of the forces preventing real scrutiny and real action on that issue. And that thing goes, that phenomenon is a continuing challenge to the quest of racial equality. You see it in the 1920s, you see it in the civil rights era. And then more recently, you know, remember Colin Kaepernick, I can't believe that was 10 years ago, that he was taking a knee in the NFL, and people, the focus was on the offence to the flag and the offence to our troops, rather than what he was actually trying to say about racial justice.
We had the January 6th insurgency at the U.S. Capitol. Many of the people who were there, who were attacking the Capitol Police, who were going into the hallways, committing vandalism and theft and trying to hang Mike Pence, they thought of themselves as patriots.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really the most extreme form of it. You know, that you know, I quote George Orwell quite a bit on his essay Notes on Nationalism, and he talks about the sinking of the ego into this body, or the imagined body of the nation. And the way in which it leads to not just aggression and support for violence, but just an inability to see the other side. The nationalist for Orwell is almost immune to disaffirming evidence, immune to facts, and sort of contrary ideas bounce off his consciousness like sort of water off a windscreen. And I think that people were very easily persuaded, you know, that the election had been stolen and there was some sort of conspiracy. And then you also see, of course, which is something that people like Orwell and Tagore, who I mentioned earlier, reference, is the way that kind of nationalism turns on the nation. It's, I mean, Orwell talks about transferred nationalism. So you mentioned the aggression directed to Mike Pence. It's almost more fratricidal in a way. It's more aggressive towards traitors within its own ranks. And yeah, that's clearly one of the more dangerous aspects of it. But too many people are willing to condone it, to sort of drape it in euphemisms. And I think that's one of the features of patriotism, is it puts a friendly gloss on sometimes very aggressive behavior.
Does a patriotism, is it or healthy patriotism or toxic patriotism, does it rely on the power of story? Because here we are about to celebrate the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, the birth of the nation, The Birth of the Country, and there is an effort to kind of reframe that. We're having a mixed martial arts fight on the grounds of the White House. We're seeing monuments in Washington, D.C. Under attack, or being, you're going to put up a giant arch for Donald Trump's birthday. There's a lot going on, and how we're going to celebrate this monumental occasion. I remember the bicentennial, and what a great thing that was. I mean, it was, people were celebrating. We were proud that it was 200 years, and we were learning about American history, and we were definitely celebrating across the nation. It was not political at all, but here we are. It does seem like it's different this time.
Yes, it is different. And I think the power of story is really crucial here. And I think that, you know, as someone who is a historian and at the more kind of present-minded end of the profession, where I really do believe in kind of trying to capture some of the energies of the past and bring them into play in current conversation, I suppose what you're trying to do is say there are other stories, there are other narratives of greatness and other heroes that you might want to bring to light. You know, on the toxic side of it, you know, I just finished a great book by the Dr. Gary Slutkin called The End of Violence. And he talks about violence as this self-reproducing phenomenon that reactivates scripts. So scripts are sort of ideas that sort of implant, you know, stories that are planted in the head. And your response to conflict is to reactivate them. Oh, well, this war, this is what we did in, you know, whatever the year may be. And this is the way to deal with it. And I think as a kind of historian who wants to pull out the other side of the American experience, I'm holding more obscure figures, less well-known. You know, Randolph Bourne, I've mentioned. Jane Addams is a bit more of a household name. And show that there are other ways to be American, other ways to be proud of the political tradition and the diversity and the land and the landscape without being nationalistic.
John F. Kennedy said, ask not what you can do for your country. Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. As he was asking people to join the Peace Corps, to go to parts of the world to help people who were undeveloped and improve their lives. So when he said, you know, what you can do for your country was to go to other countries and help them, not this America First idea of we're only concerned about what's going to happen inside our borders to make America great. Is that, how does that plug into patriotism?
I think that is like that is a perfect example. I can't believe I didn't really say anything about the Peace Corps, but not only is JFK such a great example of someone who changes his mind on the job, you know, someone who goes from being this kind of really quite an orthodox cold warrior, talking about missile gaps and taking any, accepting any challenge and standing toe to toe against the Soviets. He is kind of so chastened by the Bay of Pigs fiasco and then the Cuban Missile Crisis that he becomes a really fervent internationalist and makes this great speech in 1963, his strategy for peace speech at the American University, and then follows it up with these amazing overtures to the Soviet leader. But yeah, so he's a great example of that. But the way in which he talks about the Peace Corps as an authentic way to be an American, and he says, you know, we won't end war until there's as much prestige for the conscientious objector as there is for the soldier. You know, those are radical statements. And I think they're patriotic statements. I mean, JFK is the president, or was the president, and to say those things from that kind of bully pulpit, so to speak, to say them in the UN, where he gives a speech in September of 63, and he says, my fellow inhabitants of the planet, and this kind of gracious overtures to the world. And I think that is the really positive side of patriotism.
Today, under the Trump administration, they've dismantled and canceled U.S. aid. We're seeing the impact of that now with the outbreak and the spread and the crisis of Ebola in Africa. Yeah. Six major wars happening in Africa today. We don't even pay attention to what's happening in Somalia and Congo and places like that with these terrible wars that are under the way. The withdrawal from that arena has had consequences. You wonder, absolutely, like, well, how is that? You know, we're, if patriotism should involve global patriotism.
I think so. I don't think it should, you know, be a case of minding your own business and not having engagement. But particularly if you're the world's richest and most powerful nation, then you can't just sort of pull up the drawbridge. But yes, that's one of the ongoing tragedies of this kind of
nationalism. And to question it, say, okay, this is what's happened because the United States has no longer does U.S. you know, aid to these countries. People, children are starving. These facts are disputed by officials in the White House.
Yeah, but I think that the international, to say that, you know, I'd bring in someone like William Jennings Bryan here, because he was, you know, most people, if they know him, will know him as the guy who kind of embarrassed himself in the Scopes trial of 1925, or at least he was humiliated and died soon after as the guy who opposed the teaching of evolution in Tennessee. But before that, he had a very impressive career as a statesman and Wilson's Secretary of State for a while, and an opponent of imperialism. And he says, look, the Declaration of Independence is an internationalist idea, all people created equal, not just us. So his ideas were all about collaboration and about treaties. And I'm not sure how much, you know, he concerned himself with the question of aid. But it's a way he makes a deeply patriotic argument that we need to be in human solidarity. Same with people like Adams and Crystal Eastman, a feminist during the First World War. She's saying, look, we need to delight in other cultures. And when we do that, we'll find it very difficult to fight wars. And you know, we're part of... You know, in a sense, she anticipates King's idea of the one world house. You know, we're different families sharing the same building, ultimately.
So with the patriotism that you're exploring in your book, To Love a Country, The Problem of Patriotism in America, has this been a long-standing problem, or has it recently gotten a lot worse?
I think it is. I didn't realize the extent to which that original problem, or the original sin of slavery, in a sense, was covered up at the time of the constitutional debate. So you have the, you know, we know all about Madison and Alexander Hamilton and John Jay, less famous, who authored the Federalist Papers, which is like the ultimate statement of explaining US constitutionalism and the balance of powers, etc., in the federal system. But on the other side of the debate were these people called anti-federalists, who've not been taken so seriously, and they all had these exotic pseudonyms, like, well, not necessarily exotic, Federal Farmer and Brutus and Cato. And they warned that you're creating problems in binding places like Pennsylvania that were against slavery with South Carolina and Georgia, which had very little respect for Republican principles and were certainly not about to free their slaves. And when they pose these structural arguments, these structural critiques of the Constitution, they're sort of waved away by saying, well, no, this is providence, that the hand of God was clearly visible in the deliberations in Philadelphia. And they sort of punted into the future, in a sense. And there are just a few people at the time who said that these patriotic arguments are not going to hold water when you're forcing you know, these opposing cultures together. And I think that was the argument that was picked up on by people like William Lloyd Garrison, I've mentioned, and Douglas. You know, Frederick Douglass gives these speeches. He says, who were your daddies? You know, who were these founding fathers who were treated like, who we have to treat like God? So I think that problem, you know, militarism isn't such an issue there until the Civil War and beyond, but the problem of race and the way that form of providentialist, you know, God has chosen us, that kind of patriotism, that problem is there from the start.
But today we're seeing a high level of from the president of the United States. If you question him, you question the war that he's waging in against Iran, that is a treason, an act of treason. He has said that. And it should be the right, it should be the job of a journalist to ask questions. Why is the war not going the way that he told us it would go? And so we're going to talk more about that when we come back from the break.
Yeah.
I'll get Teresa on the air with her question, and you can call in with your comments and questions about patriotism today and whether or not it has become a problem for America. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'll be right back.
Support for TPR comes from UT San Antonio, offering degree programs and research focused on workforce development, student success, and health innovation across Texas. UTSA.edu. UT San Antonio, the University of Ambition.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies, having a conversation with historian author Dominic Erduzain. His book is To Love a Country, The Problem of Patriotism in America. You can call in 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Let's go to Teresa. And Teresa, you're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to, identify 2 points for what you all are talking about, and I think it pertains to maybe what you've already said. As a retired teacher, I know that people were always concerned about how, you know, the kids weren't saying the pledge. And I don't know about other states, but in the state of Texas, we say the pledge. We're required by law to say the pledge every day. Now, I taught high school, and a lot of the kids did not say the pledge, but you could get them to at least be quiet during that time to show respect. I don't know that the pledge means anything to them, because something that you repeat by rote probably doesn't hit like people think it does when you only do it at a baseball game or something. So I think that toxic nationalism, or nationalism in that case, does not lead to patriotism. Like, it leads to a way for other people to attack the school. In this case. And the other point I wanted to make too was that you did talk about the narrative. And the people who currently have control of our narrative are changing education through the State Board of Education by changing the TEKS for the objectives for teaching social studies throughout our system. And I think they are erasing minority contributions to our history, but also increasing the inclusion of Christianity, which has not had that big a part in our history, other than by its absence and its treatment of the people that that have lived in the past, minorities who have lived through our treatment of them.
Teresa, thank you for your call. We've seen Texas State Board of Education put requirements in there for Christian Bible passages in to be taught in at every level. We have the Ten Commandments in every classroom. In Texas, they wanted to list Moses as a founding father.
Really? Yeah. Well, Kurt Vonnegut was always interested. Why is it always Moses? Why didn't they put the Sermon on the Mount there? Because if you put the Sermon on the Mount there, you'd have a different outcome. He's not serious about that, of course. Benjamin Rush said if there was going to be anything, it should be the idea of that Jesus came to save, not destroy. But even that, of course, would be a form of... would be a breach of the wall of separation. I think I would want to say... On the Christianity thing, most of the framers or the architects of the idea of the separation of church and state came from some sort of faith standpoint. You know, we know about the Baptists. You go back to the kind of English Civil War and the fight for, you know, people like the Quakers and the Diggers and all these sects that are, and the Levellers, who are probably the most important. These kind of, at the time, considered wacky sects, but they established a right to worship against the state. And those ideas kind of evolved through people like Madison and Jefferson into what we have in the First Amendment and in the abolition of religious tests for office. So I would want to challenge that by saying it's both patriotic in the sense of following Jefferson and Madison, and it's also Christian in the sense of following these pioneers of religious liberty. I mean, think of Roger Williams in Providence, Rhode Island. So... I would want to fight that with a pretty buoyant sort of patriotic and a Christian argument. I'm fascinated by the pledge because we did not grow up doing that, but I grew up Catholic, and some of my Catholic friends will, you know, take communion every day. You know, they go to celebrate Mass and they receive the Eucharist. And yet, I to me, that didn't have the same effect. It was almost when it was a special occasion and when there'd been a break that it gave it more meaning. And I wonder whether just the repetition can be something that doesn't actually reinforce the ideas. And as you say, if you're just saying it by rote, whether, you know, we need fresher rituals, fresher kind of ceremonies to reinforce or to just re-enliven those ideals of liberty and justice for all.
I still think, even if you're saying it by rote, that background noise does have an impact on you, and it will get into your subconscious, and you will carry that with you. So, yeah.
In a positive way.
Yes. Well, in a way. Let's go to Gloria. Yeah. Let's go to Gloria on the air. Gloria, okay. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call and love your show today. I did grow up reciting the Pledge of Allegiance and learned to love my country, and I come from staunch Republicans. And I don't think, you know, as was it Rousseau who said that we are social political animals? And I just want to know what your author can suggest for what we're witnessing today and how to overcome it from his studies, because to see that our government is being held hostage and the beautiful three branches of our government is now pretty much just one branch and it's tyrannical, and I can't, you know, I call my congressman every week, but to see the grand old party become the guardian of pedophiles and this dictator leader, just it's very small-minded and greedy and arrogant, just take over and plunder and pillage our government and its buildings is just sickening, saddening.
Yeah, I mean, it's
Gloria, thank you for your call.
That, Gloria, and it is pretty dismal when you put it like that, and I, you know, in terms of my patriotic arguments, I go back to someone like John Adams, who's right there at the start. You know, he's the second president, as you know, and he's very wary about this idea of being chosen and being special. And he says, look, we're an empire of laws, not an empire of men. And once you start thinking that we're a unique body of people, a unique set of, you know, the tutors of the world, in a sense, then you will start to collapse those constitutional protections, and you will start to override all the checks and balances. So we have got that one branch reality. I, you know, what about the rituals? I just feel that we need a richer, more dynamic kind of patriotism than just the repetitive side or just the invoking. You know, that's what I find less inspiring about the Pledge of Allegiance. I think I'm not against it, but in terms of a model, I loved watching the Olympics and seeing Alyssa Liu, the figure skater. I loved seeing her fellowship and friendship with the Japanese athletes and the way they sort of held hands on the podium. I mean, that might sound a bit corny, but just, you know, sport is a great forum for competition that is friendly and is non-destructive. It's a shame that the World Cup has already been so heavily politicized and you know, we're seeing referees turned back home to Somalia, etc. But I think sport is a potential arena for a kind of healthy form of pride.
So we're talking a lot about Trump, and have other presidents done things like this? Joe Biden described efforts to restrict the overturning of voting rights as un-American, undemocratic, and unpatriotic. Is that the same thing?
It is, but I think that with someone like that, you know, one of the most striking things for me researching this book was seeing how, after 9/11, how journalists on both sides of the political divide and both parties, as you mentioned in the introduction, just were quite willing to sign away their constitutional protections. They were willing to hand over the military power and all these civil rights to the executive. And how people like, you know, Dan Rather, who was fascinating because he initially was there as a patriot saying, look, I'm an American first and a journalist second, and, you know, whatever the president wants me to do. It really, and then later on, of course, he said, well, perhaps we'd have been a bit more patriotic to ask some tougher questions about weapons of mass destruction, et cetera, and anthrax. So I think that the Biden language reminds me a bit too much of that kind of patriotism that waved the Bush administration on through in its wars after 9/11. And I think that just to say this is not who we are is not really going to solve the problem. I think that there needs to be a more critical perspective on the way in which our basic ways of thinking, our basic ways of orientating ourselves towards other nations through the military or through the UN, etc., puts us in a position of preeminence and allows us to sort of resist the more bold and radical solutions that involve cooperation.
So are we moving towards sort of a North Korean view of patriotism?
the dear leader,
a divine individual?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I mean, I think we are. I mean, I think that's the scary thing. I mean, I hesitate to bring up Lincoln because that's what, you know, a lot of people won't like my critique of Lincoln, but there's this letter when he is challenged by Horace Greeley during the Civil War, say, look, why don't you take moves to abolish slavery? And he writes back in this ponderous kind of proud sort of, I'll do this if I want to do that. You know, if I can save the Union without releasing a single slave, I'll do that. If I could save it by releasing slaves, I'll do that. He uses the first person singular, I think about 30 times in this short letter. And it just really terrifies me that people think that this is some sort of admirable statement, because I think the Civil War did create that kind of dear leader phenomenon. And those who said otherwise were often locked up. So yeah, it's an ongoing problem. And it's people like Thoreau. I mean, Henry David Thoreau says, you know, you've got 1,000 men of morality for one virtuous person who will challenge the state. That what patriotism does is just makes you worship the state, when really it should be the country and the people that we esteem, not the state and the man, and it's always a man, in charge of the state.
Got to take another break. Got a lot of callers. I'm going to get them on the air. I think I'm starting with Tim. I'll get Tim on the air first. And you can call in 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK, patriotism. Is it a problem for America? This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back.
The largest sports tournament in the world is about to arrive in Texas, the 2026 FIFA World Cup.
Teams from across the globe are set to play at Dallas Stadium and Houston Stadium in June.
Whether you're a diehard fan or just a little soccer curious, we've got you covered.
When the World Comes to Texas is a new podcast from KERA News.
We'll talk to the people holding down the sport and the culture here in Texas.
It's out now. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. Dominic Erduzane is with us. His previous book is One Nation Under Guns. His new book is To Love a Country, The Problem of Patriotism in America. And let's go to Tim. Tim, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm glad Dominic mentioned 9/11 because it directly relates to the anecdote I'd like to share today. First of all, I think patriotism is problematic when it becomes jingoistic and is used to further political motives. I recently had the opportunity to work on a documentary about 9/11 that I was assured was nonpartisan. And the more I looked into it, so they were going to screen it at the Reagan Presidential Library, and I was told it would also screen at other presidential libraries, which I took to mean the Trump Library when it's eventually built. The website for the documentary, which I'm not going to name, also had video endorsements from Marco Rubio, Kristi Noem, and Pete Hegseth. So when I realized it was a partisan, post-facto justification for the war on terror, I opted not to work on the film. So I think it's important to be critical of the people selling narratives to us for reasons that are, you know, claim to be patriotic, which are really partisan in nature. That's my comment. Thank you.
Tim, thank you for that. So Tim brings up Pete Hegseth, who calls himself the Secretary of War. Some people call him the Secretary of War Crimes. Supposed to be the Secretary of Defense. How important, how is that a giving away the game, Dominic?
Yeah, I think, thanks so much for that that story, because, you know, jingoism goes back to the late 19th century, imperialism, it's a sort of this appetite for fighting. And, you know, there was a guy called George Lipsitz who wrote about the Reagan era, actually, and talked about the way in which this kind of patriotism offered a kind of psychic reparations for the loss of autonomy and loss of power in terms of you know, welfare, economic opportunity. And it's almost like we've been, maybe duped is too strong, but we've been lulled into a kind of patriotism that neglects our ordinary lives. I mean, I have to mention Molly Ivins, because I'm one of my favorite Texans. And, you know, she sort of says, oh, was it a great idea to put someone in charge who didn't really believe in government? But she talks about how this dismantling of education and welfare were done under this sort of hushed note that, you know, it's morning in America, and how easily we can be sort of fooled into sort of signing away our rights. And of course, just to add to that, the sheer militarism, the unquestioning sense of, you know, we can't lose. This is one of the big problems, which goes all the way back to the Puritans, goes back to the 17th century Puritans, this idea that because we're chosen, we cannot lose, that God is on our side, and we may be chastened, we may be disciplined to some extent, but we're never actually going to be abandoned. And this idea in both a religious and a secular form, now it's back in its very religious form, has been such a dangerous one in terms of war.
How does masculinity fit into patriotism?
Oh, I'm so glad you're saying. I mean, I think one way I would frame this, that's why I get so excited by people like Molly Ivins and Crystal Eastman in the First World War, because Eastman says in the First World War, she's a lawyer and a feminist. She says this was the quintessential example of male mismanagement. If ever there was an argument for giving women the suffrage, the vote, it was the First World War. And you've got Jane Addams and other women from America going around in this delegation, meeting all these leaders in Europe, all of whom were saying the same things about how we can't discuss peace while we're at war, and the enemy has done this and we have to do that. And I see people like her as dismantling the masculinity that is built into patriotism. Of course, she comes back and gives this amazing lecture, speech at Carnegie Hall, and Theodore Roosevelt denounces her as just another member of the shrieking sisterhood. But she, in a sense, wants to make patriotism less patriarchal. And, you know, the same arguments there with people like Garrison, the abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison, and Thoreau, who I've already mentioned, is that they're almost building a new kind of masculinity, a masculinity that can say no to the state. And maybe it's quite manly to spend a night in jail. I mean, it was a very short night for Thoreau. I mean, he got a lot of mileage out of that. But maybe that is a new kind of masculinity. I think that's there with MLK. I mean, there are problematic sides of his masculinity, but I think he shows that you can be a man and a patriot and be nonviolent.
Let's go to Randall. And Randall, thanks for holding on. You're on the air.
Well, this has to do with a word you used earlier, David, a word that, you know, it's kind of where the problem lies, things that Teresa, Gloria, and Tim referred to. That word is ideals. You mentioned our nation's ideals. Certainly the American ideals of the late 18th century changed over time so much that by the time of the bicentennial 50 years ago, we had become more expansive. More people had the right to vote. Our definition of citizenship had changed. We were enjoying the last gasp of a healthy middle class. Now, since the emergence of MAGA, those elements of true progress are being slowly rolled back, and the flag is being used to cloak this fundamental regression of things that we came to cherish, things like an open exchange of ideas, the sanctity of medical and reproductive rights, the once open arms we extended to newcomers, which have now been replaced by brass knuckles on each hand. Who can feel any kind of authentic patriotism, not jingoism, as Tim mentioned, but patriotism, when so many of our American ideals of the 21st century are being slowly stripped away?
Randall, thank you for the call. Dominic.
That's a great comment. I really do appreciate that. I think that, you know, I'm talking about people like King and Jane Addams and others. And, you know, as someone who would define myself as, I suppose, maybe as a conservative liberal, in the sense that my liberalism is very historical. I'm a historian, and I want to be able to reactivate the past to some extent. And, I'm just thinking of people like Thomas Paine, his tract Common Sense, saying that America, maybe this is a good side of Providence, America is there as the refuge from the fratricidal toils of Europe and to be an asylum for the persecuted of the earth. Ben Franklin says the same thing. I think it's, you know, they might be white males, but they articulate a model for America that is historical and exciting and congruent with those ideals of the Declaration of Independence. I think what you said about the open exchange of ideas, that is where patriotism gets toxic, when you just have to close your mouth and you're told that it's unpatriotic. And I think that's where we do need a more vigorous response to nationalism, to say that actually this is, you know, this is tearing apart the nation. You think about someone like Jefferson, respect for the press in some respects, but he didn't like, in a letter, he said he didn't enjoy being dished up as an anti-federalist. He says, I'm not a federalist. I'm not an anti-federalist. I'm my own person. You know, it's the last degradation of a thinking human being, he says, just to be purely identified with a party. And I think that where a party defines our nationality and disagreement with that becomes unpatriotic, then we've really left, we've left the realms of the American ideals. So I really appreciate your comment. Thank you.
Jenny, and let's get Jenny on the air. Hey, Jenny, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. God, this is just such a wonderful conversation. I just kind of wanted to acknowledge the kind of juxtaposition of these two dualities. I mean, it's not just about patriotism versus nationalism, but it's like, you know, there really are reasons to be patriotic and to love this country, you know, and those are our ideals. Things like, you know, liberty and justice for all and bring me your tired, your poor, and your huddled masses yearning to be free, and ideals that are, you know, iterated in the amendment to the Constitution and in the Declaration of Independence. There's a lot to love there. But all of those things got there because of questioning of authority, because of holding the government under a microscope. And I just think until we acknowledge, though, that even though this country was funded on such lofty ideals, it was also founded on a lot of degradation of human dignity, whether it's the original sin of slavery or, you know, the original sin of colonialism and how we displaced and murdered millions. I mean, I really do think that until we are able to hold in one hand our promises and our ideals, and like your author said, you know, that's a worldly ideal. It's not just for this people in this country or on this continent. But until we're able to hold that in one hand and really, truly acknowledge and swallow the jagged little pill of colonialism and slavery and really sit with our sins and the way that we've gone against what we call the American ideals, that we're going to just be in this bad marriage, you know, sitting, you know, not wanting to admit our wrongs, you know. And I just think that until we're really able to sit with that and acknowledge that, and I think that the one reason that some of this is coming to the head and that people are and the administration are trying to erase history, you know,
Jenny, I got to wrap you up. I got to wrap you up. We're running out of time. And thank you for your call, Jenny. We ended on a good call. Appreciate that. So, Dominic, fantastic. Your response.
Oh, well, thanks so much. It's a great comment. I think that we're so binary in our thinking that we want to cancel people, or we want to say, you know, the founders were terrible, or they were heroes. I just while you were talking, I found myself thinking of Douglas, Frederick Douglass, who initially believed that the Constitution was this kind of covenant with death and agreement with hell, this radical critique. And then he says, well, actually, you don't have to judge it by the slavery clauses. You can take the best of it. You can take the Republican ideals, the ideals of fairness and accountability. And work with that. And I think that as a historian, I'm prone to this myself, to having my heroes and my villains, but we have to look at the country in the same way. It's like a family with a complicated family history, that we can say there are good things, there are great things.
But there are things happening right now. I don't have to look back 100 years to say there are jagged little pills. We're incarcerating families. We're doing mass deportations. Yeah. We're not helping the rest of the world when we can.
But the good is there. You look at the protests, you look at Minnesota, the people came out and they really managed to sort of put a stop to that harassment. There are so many glimmers of light, and I think that it's so important to be able to look with, almost bifocal lenses, that we have to be able to see, to identify the positive within the morass. Yeah. And sometimes be honest about the fact that it is a grim time.
I mean, claim your own patriotism. Make it your own. I want to thank you so much, Dominic Erduzane. His book is To Love a Country, The Problem of Patriotism in America. Great having you on.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thank you for listening.
The This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.